Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. On today's episode, I sit down with Amanda Knox, who is an exoneree, journalist, public speaker, and author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Waiting to be Heard. Between 2007 and 2015, she spent nearly 4 years in an Italian prison and 8 years on trial for a murder she didn't commit. The controversy over Amanda's case made international headlines for nearly a decade and thrust her into the spotlight, where she was vilified and shamed. Today, Amanda works to shed light on issues of wrongful conviction, truth-seeking, and public shaming. We talk her acquittal from the murder she didn't commit and the lasting effects the media has had on her mental health. For those who are not familiar with your story, do you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. My name is Amanda Knox. I was wrongly convicted while studying abroad in Italy, and the case became this international sensation, and I was sort of dragged through the mud in the media landscape and eventually became one of the lucky ones and was found innocent and got to come home. But it's definitely been a life-altering experience for me, and I'm very excited to talk about the mental health aspect because it's real.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on, and once again, thank you for coming on. It's so funny, and people may not know this, but that we both grew up in Seattle and we actually attended the same high school.
Yeah. Didn't you say that I came to speak to your class after? Yeah,
I didn't know if you would remember that, but my senior year creative writing class, you actually came and spoke to like a group of only like 10 to 15 students. I feel like you kind of like snuck into the class and you told your story, and it was really the first time that I was able to, obviously I'd seen stuff on the news, but to really experience you as, oh wow, she's just another woman. She's a real person.
Yeah. I'm actually really curious what you remember about that, because I have a very clear memory about that, that sort of ties into this mental health aspect of it. And I want to share that with you and see if you remember it. But I'm curious to know like what you remember from that encounter.
You talked about your experience in the Italian prison. You talked about the very like traumatic details of being strip searched and just how scary it was. And I remember you seeming very solemn. There was like a heaviness to what you were saying. I mean, everyone in the class was probably like 17, 16.
Yeah.
But you allowed us to ask you any questions. You were really forthcoming and really open. And like, I'm very appreciative of that experience.
Yeah. No, it was interesting because it was the first time that I had ever been asked to speak to strangers about it.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. I had never, ever spoken to anyone outside of my family. Like, I had just come home from prison. It was very, very shortly after that. And our mutual teacher invited me to come and like talk about it. And I was so, so nervous. I didn't know what anybody thought of me. I had been used to being sort of ridiculed and blamed for what happened to me. And so I really wasn't sure what it was that I was even going to say that would be meaningful. And I was still very much processing the fact that I was just in prison, like not that long ago. So I'm like, that was, you know, a big part of what I ended up talking about. I know that there were a lot of questions that were asked, and some of them were like really astute and thoughtful. But I do remember walking away from one question pinging me in a bad way, which was someone asked me what it was like to be famous. And I remember thinking, like, I'm not a celebrity. Like, I'm the opposite of what you would anybody would ever want to be famous. And I didn't have words to talk about what it felt like to have my life and my identity sort of taken over by the story. So that really stuck with me, where I was like, huh, is the only thing that like matters to people the fact that they've heard of me before?
And that there's some notoriety.
Yeah.
When I was preparing for this interview, actually, that was a concept that kept coming up for me, was this idea of like involuntary public figuredom, this involuntary fame that you went through. You know, you were just a normal American college student studying abroad.
Yeah.
And so I kind of want to bring it back to like, what did you even want to do with your life? Who were you? What were you like before this all happened?
Yeah. I was kind of I was a nerdy hippie kid. Like I really loved to rock climb and go camping and be out in nature. I was very into poetry and language. I really wanted to be a translator. So like my ideal job would be to like translate poetry for a living. How cool would that be? And I grew up in a divorced household in the sense that my dad lived just a few blocks away in his own home. And so I was very aware that even across homes, there are like different cultures and different expectations and ideologies that settle in different houses. But also, you know, my dad was a super American guy and my mom was very European. She was born in Germany. I had an oma. We did, you know, we ate rouladen and goulash and like that kind of stuff. So I was highly attuned to the fact that there are other cultures and other ways of being and other ideas that I wanted to be a bridge for. I always felt like I was a bridge. So that was my goal. I wanted to be a bridge builder through language. And I went to Italy in the hopes of immersing myself in a culture that I didn't have immediate access to. I was actually studying German as well at the time, and I could have gone to Germany. Like I actually was looking at study abroad programs in Germany as well, but I figured I have family that already lives in Germany. I have family at home that already speaks German. I should immerse myself in the culture that is most foreign to me.
I think that says a lot about your personality and like willing to take risks and stuff, even at a young age. It's funny, you mentioned this earlier, actually, or with the fame comment, but in contemporary society today, it seems at least like younger generations with TikTok and all these new social media platforms, that being famous or being in the spotlight has become a goal of a lot of people. And so you're this anomaly, because even when you put the trauma of the murder, the trial, the imprisonment to the side, what was the experience like of being thrust into the spotlight?
I mean, I'm curious to know what your experience of this is as well, because I've seen the bitter dark side of the spotlight, right? Like my access to the spotlight has been very dark. It has been all the worst consequences that one can face being in the spotlight. And I think I am sort of on the cusp. Like I'm a millennial, I'm not Gen Z. Going into Italy and going, you know, while studying abroad, it wasn't on my radar to be someone who was known. That wasn't something that I felt was one, even a possibility, because back then there was like MySpace and Facebook. There wasn't Twitter, there wasn't TikTok, there wasn't Instagram. Anybody who was on YouTube was someone who was tech savvy, and that was certainly not what I was. I knew how to use a Word document, and that was pretty much it, and Google Translate. So being famous was never a goal of mine, and it was never part of my sense of self, that aspiration to have a public self. And it's something that I think everyone has to think about now, because no one is immune from having a digital self and a, you know, physical world real self. Both of them are real. It's just one of them we have more of an ability to construct, or so we think. So in my case, what I found is that it is very, very easy for the identity that exists in people's minds and that exists in digital and other kinds of media can absolutely be 100% out of your control. Like that, from the get-go, from my arrest, I was not a voice in my own story.
Yeah.
There were a million people who were talking about who I was and what I did and what kind of person I was and what my thoughts were and what putting words into my mouth. And I was the person who had the least agency in that equation. I was behind bars, in my own story. And that is the potential dark consequence of having an identity that you build outside of the framework of, here I am, you're sitting across from me in a room together. Like, we have a life together. We understand each other. And I'm curious to know what your experience has been with that, because I have not had the experience of constructing my own public self. I've had the experience of having to deconstruct a public self that's a lot of other people made and then try to substitute it with my actual self. But I haven't had, like, I've never really had the opportunity to build my public self from the ground up. And I'm curious to know, like, how that experience has been for you, and if you've felt any kind of similar problems with whether or not you've had agency or voice in that battle.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like I've kind of controlled the narrative. And I think that's a big difference between you and I, is I have constantly put myself out there. I have been posting on Instagram since I was 16 years old. I actually started on Tumblr, like talking to other teenagers in Seattle and across the country. And it was this very kind of natural progression of gaining more followers and then moving to New York for college. And it's, yeah, it's been on my own terms. Mm. I have definitely had a brush with trolls and kind of negative media, but that's why, to me, it's so unfathomable the level to which you experienced it, because I experienced it on such a minute level and it was traumatizing.
Sure.
I remember when I first launched my blog website almost 5-6 years ago, the New York Post reached out to me and they said, oh, we want to do an article on this cool new blog you're doing. And I was really young and naive. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. And they came over and they did an interview in person. And then I remember they launched the article like a couple weeks later. And the title was, I Fuel Fantasies for Older Men, something along those lines.
Charming.
Like, I'm a young woman and that's what I do. They included a line that I had a incestual relationship with my brother.
Isn't that so funny? So clearly the older men who are in charge of the New York Post were having some fantasies about you. And they were like totally not hearing anything that you were saying about what your thing was and what you were doing and connecting people and talking openly about sexuality. No, for them, you were reduced to, I'd fuck that. Headline.
Yeah. But literally a woman came over, a woman wrote the article. And I remember reading it and crying, being like, holy shit, this is so embarrassing. What is my dad gonna think? And my dad was like, don't respond. Don't respond to them. You'll just give them more fuel to the flame. And I was like, you know what? Fuck that. I am going to respond.
Oh, wow.
So
what
I wrote a I wrote a letter in response to the journalist and actually got picked up by a couple news sites. And I was like, you're an older woman. You should be setting an example for me, not ripping me down. And that was kind of the start to being more outspoken. And I'm sure you can relate. You have to have some form of like a thick skin.
Well, if anything, what that sort of makes me think about is, you know, you've had the experience of being targeted and basically turned into a piece of sloppy content, like scandalous sloppy content for someone that like grabs a headline of, you know, for someone sees that headline.
Yeah, some clickbait.
Yeah, it's just some bullshit clickbait. So basically you were just treated like bullshit clickbait. And I 100% know what that feels like. And I really appreciate your impulse to call the journalist out. I think there's this sort of sense that like, oh, this is just the way the world is. Headlines are just going to be this way. This is what journalism is. And so a lot of journalists who write these things and produce this content hide behind, well, this is just what the world wants. This is just my job. And it's like, no, you're making a choice to treat another human being this way. And you don't have to do that. In fact, as you pointed out in your letter, you're an older woman. And as an older woman who came into my space to talk to me about my story, I had an expectation that you were going to be setting a good example for me. And in fact, you just exploited me. And I think that that is something that I've been processing, where I'm thinking, as someone who participates in media and understands the power of media, and you know, I have a podcast and I do journalism and I write articles, this is my work. Because I recognize how important it is to share information and to share ideas through journalism. But you don't have to, like, there are right ways and wrong ways to do it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to exploit people for clickbait to do your job.
And to get a story.
Exactly. There are a million stories out there that are worth telling that you are just passing by because you get an easy click by exploiting this other human being. And that's a shame. It's really a shame for the medium, and it's a shame for that human being who has cast themselves as the producer of that kind of content.
So you didn't actually start talking to the media for a while. I know you weren't on social media, and I'm wondering what influenced your choice to start an account, to start speaking out on your story, to write your book, to start the podcast.
Yeah, so there was a period of time when I first came home that I thought that it might be possible for me to go back to the life that I had before all of that bad stuff happened in Italy. I didn't want to be in conversation with this whole giant mess that I had nothing to do with, right? Like, I didn't do this crime. I didn't make this trial happen. This is all everyone else is doing. And I just wanted to get back to my life, my friends and my family, and going back to school and feeling like I felt like I had just lost years of my life for nothing. And I wanted to sort of get back on track. And I felt like if I engaged with the world and everyone talking about me, that I was going to basically be distracted away from what I really wanted, which was my life back. And over the course of going back to school, doing a bunch of writing and thinking and processing, but also realizing that, you know, on my way to school, paparazzi would be taking photos of me and people would be accosting me at the grocery store and outside of my apartment building, and kids in my class would take pictures of me and post them online. I was constantly being exposed to the fact that the life that I thought I was gonna get to go back to didn't exist anymore. Like Amanda, the person that I was, who just was a girl who liked to rock climb and go hiking and study poetry and languages, that life did not exist for me anymore. And I had to be in conversation with the narrative that was around me, because it was impacting how people were interacting with me on a day-to-day basis. And I decided at a certain point, fuck this. I'm not, like, of all the people who are talking about me and saying who I am and what I'm like, I should at the very least be one of those voices. And if people want to believe me, they can believe me. If people don't want to believe me, at the very least, I can't say that I haven't tried to convey who I really am.
And take back some agency.
Yeah. T- take back some agency and also feel like I am actually a powerful voice. I felt like I wasn't for so long. And it's been a long time of me sort of realizing that I actually can be a powerful voice in my own narrative. When I was going through it and just starting out and like just getting a little Instagram account and having it be just with my little, you know, my sisters and just starting to have these little things and write little articles. I was writing articles under a pseudonym at the time. I was putting my voice out there and I felt like my voice didn't matter. Like it didn't, for 4 years, I was in prison telling people that I was innocent and no one believed me. No one seemed to care. And so it reiterated for me this false sense of powerlessness, that my voice didn't matter. And I had to fight back against that impulse to feel diminished, to feel like I didn't matter, and put my voice out there anyway. And, you know, to this day, people really try to convince me that my voice doesn't matter. And I have realized that they are just very, very wrong and very, very cruel.
How did you get to that point? You are confident with your voice. Like, do you see a therapist? Did you see one when you got back? Like, how have you worked? Like, I said this before, but like, even you just telling me what you just said, like, it makes me emotional. Like, my eyes are tearing up a little bit. Just like how violated you were on such a big level, and like how gaslit you were for years, and not only by people face to face, but so many people on the internet and strangers, and like you said, even in the store. And I just can't imagine what the psychological implications of that have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think gaslighting is a really good way to describe it, because how the narrative of me is framed and how the whatever version of me is in other people's minds impacts whether or not they want to have anything to do with me. And so that has to do with jobs, it has to do with relationships, it has to do with opportunities, it all has to do with whether or not someone wants to ever listen to my podcast. Like there's already I know that there's already a lens through which people
view you,
are able to see me even, and are able to even decide for themselves whether they want to hear anything I have to say. And that's an ongoing battle. Convincing myself that my voice mattered took a lot of work, honestly. I tried seeing a therapist and it wasn't as helpful as I had hoped, honestly, because I felt like I was in such a unique situation. I wasn't just dealing with the PTSD of imprisonment, and I wasn't just dealing with the PTSD of almost losing my entire life to prison for a crime I didn't commit. I was grieving my loss of, like, an existential loss of self, and the feeling that, like, I didn't matter. Like, everywhere I looked, it was just reinforced to me that I didn't really matter, and what I thought and what I felt didn't matter. And it was thanks to a few things that I started to realize that what I did think did matter. One of them is loving people in my life who genuinely cared to know how I felt and how I was processing things, but also some people who gave me the opportunity to not just say, this is what happened, and this is what happened, and this is what happened, basically recite the chronology of events about that case, but to also ask me, what do you think about what happened? What do you feel about what happened?
Yeah, exactly.
Those kinds of questions suddenly make you realize that, like, whatever is happening inside of me also matters. It's not just what happened to me that matters, but really, really what matters is what's happening inside of me as a response. And what I found is that when I talk to people about what it all meant to me, people were surprised by what I had to say, but in a good way. And that keeps happening to me, where I tend to talk about how I feel about my prosecutor or how I feel about the journalists who did this to me and what I want to do in response. And people go, whoa, that doesn't match up at all with the Foxy Noxy that I heard about in the tabloids. And so weirdly, when people finally expose themselves to me, I find that there is this beautiful moment of revelation that can happen if that person is open to me, because I don't harbor a lot of anger. And in fact, I genuinely understand how a lot of people could get really wrapped up and compelled and convinced by a narrative of a psychopathic, you know, whore woman. It's just so tantalizing, like just, you know, just like the young girl who lives up to men's fantasies, like people want to think that. And it's not even totally their fault. Like, it's just sort of baked into our culture and our society and our instincts even.
It's a story as old as time.
And so, of course, people are going to buy into it. And you just have to sort of go, knock, knock. I'm a person. And then they go, oh my God.
Yeah.
Or they don't. And then they're horrible to you. And that's also something that we all deal with. Like you never know if someone's going to see you. And I just know so much what it feels like to not be seen that I've maybe built up a lot of, understanding and, systems of processing that so that it doesn't just become something that I obsess over or I feel like is how I should feel about myself, right? Because like one of the things that when a whole world is telling you, oh, you're a whore, you're a psychopath, is you're like, well, if I'm the only one who's saying, you know, I'm not a whore and a psychopath, well, what good is that? I might as well be a whore and a psychopath because everyone is saying it. So,
and also you were so young. I think that's a huge part of this. You know, like you were literally what in your very early 20s.
Yeah.
Like those are years of figuring yourself out and figuring out what your identity is. So I can't imagine having the whole world kind of stick this label on you.
Yeah.
While you're in the phase of your life of trying to figure out who you are on your own.
Yep. Yeah. And I'm 33 now. And I gotta say, my 20s were rough. My 20s were, I'm almost, you know, when I eventually have kids, I don't even quite know what I'm gonna tell them about their 20s, which is a very important part of a person's life where they are figuring themselves out. They're being an adult for the first time, but they're being a clumsy adult, an adult who's discovering themselves. And I didn't really get to discover myself. I had to discover myself by digging myself out of a grave. And I'm still feel like I'm doing that, which gives me something to fight for. But also is this thing that I wish I could build up myself and my life around something that I've actually done as opposed to something I didn't do and had nothing to do with. Like that's, I think, the biggest sort of mind fuck for me is like, no matter what I do, I am perpetually and always in conversation with something that I didn't even do.
What's so fucked up is I feel like most people don't even know the name of the guy who actually went to prison for committing the murder.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out.
Like, I'm like, what the?
Thank you for pointing that out, because that has been like the cherry on top is like a lot of people don't know the name of my roommate who was murdered.
Yeah, they just know your name.
They just know my name. And they don't know the name of the guy who raped and murdered her. They just know my name. And that is insane. It's disrespectful to her and her family and their suffering. And it's disrespectful to reality because here we go. Here's like, talk about letting somebody off the hook. Like, this guy doesn't have to live the rest of his life with, you know, the world looking over his shoulder, being like, what's he doing? You know, he's the guy who did this. Like, no, I'm the one who's carrying that burden. And, you know, I'm not the kind of person who thinks that punishment for the sake of punishment is valuable.
Yeah.
I've come to that realization because I spent years in prison with people who were not getting any better and any safer for society by being put through the experience that they were put through, whether they were guilty or not. I've learned a lot about the criminal justice system just by virtue of being that close to it. And I've gone through a lot of trouble to understand and learn how punishment and judgment impacts people and what effect it has. So I'm not convinced that Rudy Gadet spending the rest of his life in prison is the answer to this problem. What I do think, though, is that accountability matters and that acknowledgement matters. And what is utterly lacking in this case is acknowledgement and accountability from him, and acknowledgement and accountability from the media about what this case is and why it matters. I'm actually quite peripheral to it. And it shouldn't be the Amanda Knox case. It should be the Meredith Kercher case and the Rudy Gadet case. And the fact that the media continues to anchor it, to me, is a disservice to the gravity of the situation.
I watched the documentary, obviously, and I was just looking at like old tabloids preparing for this conversation with you. And when the story broke, some things you were called were Foxy Noxy, devil with an angel face, the ice maiden, mm-hmm. demonic she-devil, mm-hmm. an enchanting witch, mm-hmm. a femme fatale, sex and drug crazed party girl. Like, these are literal tabloids I pulled from like UK and US sources. And mm-hmm. do you feel like the way you were portrayed in the media would even happen today? Like, if this case was present day in a post Me Too era?
Yeah, I don't feel like I've had my Me Too moment.
Yeah.
To be honest. I think it would be harder to get away with today. However, I don't think that we're at a place where we, like, as a society, we have a sophisticated relationship with judgment. If anything, I feel like we're sort of at this moment dangerously entrenching ourselves with a comfortability with scapegoating and judgment that I'm worried about. I think it's harder to do so in that very explicit way towards a woman attacking her sexuality. I think that's harder to do post Me Too, but that's not to say that it's not possible. And if anything, I think it remains a problem.
Yes.
That as soon as you are accused of any kind of transgression, much less a crime, that people suddenly feel very comfortable putting prejudicial, stereotypical ideas onto you when they're talking about you. So, and I've seen this time and time again in the criminal justice system, where, like, as soon as an innocent person or any person is accused of a crime, suddenly all those things that you wouldn't say around the dinner table about Black people or about women or about white guys, like, all of a sudden, all of that becomes fair game when you're talking about that person who's now being defined due to a crime or a transgression, whether they did it or not.
Well, it's a very burn the witch at the stake.
Yes, very much so. And like, you become a symbol. And that's the thing that I came to understand also, and maybe one of the reasons why I realized that my voice could matter, is that the thing that people hated, the person that people wanted to burn at the stake, wasn't even me. It was an idea of me that had nothing to do with me. And so it was easy for me to see how there was a lot of hatred being directed towards not even me, but an idea of me. And my strategy in trying to reclaim my own narrative was to simply point out that that idea of me, that doesn't even exist.
It's not real.
But here's something that does exist, a person. Yeah.
Yeah. There are a few things that happened during your trial that I wanted to ask you about and kind of clear up or hear more about. But so during your trial, you were told that you were HIV positive, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was, I guess it was before my trial started. But in the first several weeks of my imprisonment, there was a whole lot of mind fuckery going on.
Yeah, the prosecution was playing.
Yeah, and like to this day, I don't have great answers as to whose idea was this or why this happened. But what I can tell you is that early on in my imprisonment, they were taking DNA swabs, they were taking hair from me, they were doing all of that. For the sake of the investigation, you know, fingerprints, footprints, everything. I was, you know, photographed naked. There was no privacy anymore. And at a certain point, I was brought down into the doctor's office and in the prison, and I was told that I had tested positive for HIV. And I was shocked. And what was also startling about this is it wasn't just like a doctor in the room telling me like, hey, just so you know, this personal information. Like, there was a prison official there who had spent the last several weeks interrogating me in a private room and asking me if I would have sex with him and doing all of that. And so he walked me out of that room and said to me, well, you should have thought of that before you fucked all those people. Maybe you should think about all the people you had sex with to figure out who gave you HIV. And so I, in tears...
But this was false information.
This was false information. And I don't know if this was, like, it seems very convenient. If it was just a mistake, it was a very convenient mistake in the sense that he suggested to me that I go back and think about who it was that I had sex with who gave me HIV. I went straight to my room and in tears started journaling, which they knew I was doing. I was journaling and keeping track of all my thoughts. And then the very next day, they raided my room and took every single piece of paper that I had ever written on.
And they leaked it.
Leaked that story to the headlines of the list of people that I'd ever had sex with, my thoughts about dying in prison from HIV. Portraying me as this whore who had had sex with like 7 men over the course of a few weeks, when really it was, I was listing every single partner that I had ever had in my whole life.
But regardless, even if you had slept with 7 people in a few weeks, what does that have to do with the case? Why were they so enamored by your sex life, but yet your boyfriend at the time wasn't scrutinized to the same level?
Yeah, the prosecution really, really tried to hammer home the Madonna whore dichotomy, right? Like their whole theory about why I would kill another young woman who was my friend and roommate was that, well, we actually secretly hated each other because she was a pure, virginal person and I was a whore. And just by virtue of that, I was going to kill her. Like, that's just the way that what a whore is going to do in response, like when she's next to a pure virginal person, she's going to resent her and she's going to ultimately try to corrupt and then destroy her. That was the story that was being presented in court. And I mean, I was sitting there in court thinking, this is insane. Does everyone like realize how insane this is? Like, that's not what real people are like. I'm not like that. Meredith is not like that. It's not, you know, and yet it was this age old story that pinged for people. And it because we had heard the story so often, it felt somehow true. And that's what I was up against. And there was no amount of evidence and rationality that could speak to the like the visceral core of people as much as this idea that like a whore would just destroy a virgin. Like, that was just too tempting of a story.
I mean, I can imagine that, like, at least while this was happening, at the time, that you felt some level of unwarranted shame around your sex life, especially when your journal, your diary got leaked. Do you feel like that feeling has diminished now?
Absolutely. At the time and for a long time afterwards, I felt like my sexuality was weaponized against me and therefore was something that I couldn't acknowledge and that I needed to be very, very excruciatingly private about. I didn't date people I hadn't already known from forever ago. And I was terrified that, like, should anyone ever get pictures of me through a window, it would be portrayed that I was, like, exposing myself. So for, you know, like, there's a million ways that because I'm pre-labeled the whore, any kind of openness or even violation of my privacy would be viewed as a count against my character. And what I've come to realize over time, however, is not only is that a unacceptable and unrealistic expectation about female sexuality, I'm a human being just like everyone else, and I have a sexuality that is an important part of me, but also I could have been a professional dominatrix at the time, and that shouldn't have happened. Like, it doesn't matter. In fact, my sexuality had nothing to do with it. And the fact that, like, people made it about my sexuality just goes to show how broken the system was and how broken our society is, that we're willing to vilify someone simply because they have sexuality. Like, yeah. that's how unhealthy our relationship with sexuality is in our society. And that's why I love what you're doing, which is, like, actually, sexuality is a healthy thing and we should talk about it. And actually, we're all better for it, that we're open with our sexuality, because then we can understand each other better and not cross lines that don't need to be crossed.
Well, it's the most natural thing in the world. It's like the thing that relates each and every one of us. It's how most of us got here. Of course, yes. There are petri dish babies these days and IVF and stuff.
But not for lack of trying.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm wondering if you feel like your case would have unfolded in the same way if you were a man?
Oh, gosh. I mean,
like, I think so much of it is, yeah, what you're saying, like, this intense or this unhealthy relationship with sexuality. But there is a difference between the men who are involved in the case and you, as this personified as this beautiful young American woman, mm-hmm. Sexualized. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that you're a woman.
Certainly. I think it's hard to say, like, what would have happened if this, like, fundamental thing was different.
Yeah, of course.
Like, if I were the lone guy living in a house full of girls and one of the girls ends up raped and murdered, maybe I would have been, accused or suspected. That could be the case. I definitely would be facing a whole different set of prejudices and stereotypes that, and very likely this wouldn't be a case that would be on anybody's radar. Because the reason why it became so big and why the narrative became so important was because people's reputations were at stake, because the world was watching. The world was watching and everyone had to be right. and they weren't willing to admit that they were wrong. And it's been a long and difficult thing to unravel, that I'm still unraveling to this day, because people are genuinely, without even intentionally realizing it, want to believe that there's something fundamentally wrong with a young outgoing girl who is openly sexual and I don't know, it's kind of sad. I think we're all getting a little bit more sophisticated when it comes to sexuality. Which is great, and it's due in large part because we're finally talking about it and we're not stigmatizing it. But yeah, if I were not a woman, I think this would have unfolded very, very, very differently.
Yeah, I agree with you. What do you say, or what do you have to say to the people who don't believe you, that believe that you did this?
Oh, I mean, at this point, I don't feel like I have to be in conversation with them, honestly.
Yeah.
I was forced to be in conversation with them for a long, long time because my life and my freedom depended on it. I'm less focused on convincing people about the facts of my case anymore because honestly, like, if you don't believe me, that's your problem. Like, if you don't enjoy facts, then that's your problem.
Yeah.
I instead care more about people cultivating a mindset of compassionate skepticism when it comes to ongoing cases that are unfolding in real time. So one of the big motivating factors for me in coming back into the world and having a voice was noticing that it was happening to other people, other women, other people. And I felt almost a little crazy, like, does no one else notice that we're all just scapegoating someone right now, or that we're just sort of weirdly attacking this person for their sexuality right now? Like, does no one notice that that's happening? And I felt like I had this sort of bullshit radar where I noticed when people were doing that to others because I was so sensitive to it. So I started speaking up about it, and I started speaking up about this very human and understandable impulse to judge that wasn't always resulting in the best outcome or an outcome that was based in truth, and that the truth mattered.
Can you tell us a little bit about that work that you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it started out with the Scarlet Letter reports with Facebook, where I was interviewing other women who had been vilified and shamed in the media. But that has transformed over time into different, like my podcast, The Truth About True Crime first, where I tried to talk to people who found themselves at the center of true crime stories and to look at true crime stories from the inside out. So instead of like saying, here are the facts, let's judge the facts, like, what does it feel like to be at the center of that story and how are they processing it? And today I have a podcast called Labyrinths, where I interview people who find themselves at the center of a labyrinth. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a true crime story, but a story that is bigger than them, that can result in a lot of judgment that is coming from the outside. But there is a real person who's navigating this space without any direction and with a lot of false turns ahead of them to find their way out and retain who they are and discover who they are in the process. A great example, and I'll send this to you, I think it would be interesting, is I interviewed Samantha Geimer, who was the girl who was raped by Roman Polanski back in the 70s. She was 13 years old, and she became the center of this insane, you know, media story about like, oh, we got to take down this, you know, big Hollywood guy, like, talk about a Me Too story. Like, here's this young girl who was raped by Roman Polanski, and her experience of how the media treated her, she says, was worse than the rape itself. And that if she had to experience one or the other, the media or the rape, she would take the rape. Wow. And so that is a fantastic and interesting story that gets into the nuances of the difference between being a real human being with real feelings and being made into a symbol of something. So that's a kind of story that I'm looking to tell. And I'm trying to, a lot of people reach out to me and ask me things like, how do you take back your narrative? How do you not let the narrative that people are constructing about you take over your life and destroy you? How do you deal with that? I get that question all the time. And the answer is not that I have answers, but that your voice matters. Your perspective matters. Yeah. Do not let anyone ever tell you that what you think and what you feel doesn't matter, because it does. That is the truth. And that is the power of your own narrative. So don't ever underestimate it.
Thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And if people want to follow anything that I'm doing, they can visit knoxrobinson.com. I try to be really responsive to people reaching out to me on Instagram and on Twitter, because one of the great challenges in this world is feeling seen and heard. And if I can hear and see you, I want to do my small part, because I know what it feels like to go unseen and unheard.